Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. The last few weeks, my shows have been pretty uniformly dedicated to Gaza and the Palestinian cause, and it's going to continue to be like that until a ceasefire is declared. There still is no ceasefire in Gaza, even though the entire world has been calling for one. Hundreds of thousands of people have been in the streets in, you know, cities like London, New York, Washington, D.C., Toronto, Johannesburg, South Africa, Kuala Lumpur, you know, you name it. Like, all around the world. We've seen a tremendous outpouring of solidarity for the Palestinian people as they are subjected to genocide by the apartheid Israeli regime. And over the last few weeks, I've talked about the carnage. I've had a lot of clips that have discussed the carnage, which we are standing up against. I mean, in Guelph over the weekend, there was an incredible outpouring of solidarity. I was there. It was a really impressive turnout at that rally, at that march. I was very happy to be a part of it. But what I haven't really done is on this show, I haven't really gotten into the personal tragedy, the human toll, beyond the figures, beyond the numbers. And of course, as of now, more than 10,000 people have died in Gaza. The death toll is absolutely horrendous. And, there was that's the Gaza Ministry of Health. There's actually Israeli estimates that put it at more like closer to 20,000. So much for the Israeli propaganda that was trying to downplay the figures and all that. But I haven't really gotten into the human side, the human stories of people who have experienced this, who have gone through hell. And I feel I should get into that today. Really need to hear that. I mean, what I'm about to play for you right now, I'm going to play a clip from the Electronic Intifada, from their podcast, which came out over the weekend. I believe it was on the 5th when this came out. And they were speaking to a woman, a Palestinian woman who is a visiting professor at the University of Alberta. Actually, I think it was the University of Edmonton. And who lost dozens of family members in Gaza. And I'm talking just one day. Lost something like 30 members of her extended family. And I mean, there's nothing I can say that does justice to her story. So I'm just going to turn over to that clip from the Electronic Intifada podcast. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We are now going to bring in our friend Hada Ajil. She's a third generation Palestinian refugee from Beit Daras. She's a visiting professor in political science at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Israeli airstrikes have killed 36 members of her family in Khan Yunis. Ghada is joined by her daughter, Ghaida, who lived in Gaza from 2021 until just this past summer. Ghada, you wrote this piece in The Guardian just yesterday, and the opening lines are, "My family home was supposed to be in the safe zone in southern Gaza. But last week, the bombs came anyway, without warning." Can you introduce yourself and your daughter and tell us about your family and what happened?
Well, thank you, Noura. My name is Ghada, and I am a third-generation Palestinian refugee. My parents and grandparents have lived in Beit Daras, now a village that is no more on the map. It has been depopulated, destroyed during 1948 Nakba. My family, my parents, grandparents, has made the journey from Beit Daras to Sawafir, to Hamama, to Izdud, to Jabalia, to Gaza, to end in Khan Yunis camp, waiting for the day in which they will be returned to their home. 75 years now, the family has been waiting. It seems like the history repeats itself, because my sister in Gaza City have been, under this shelling, constant bombardment, and under the direction or following the direction to move to safe area, she moved from Gaza City to the south, to my home in the refugee camp. And there that the granddaughter of my sister has been killed, murdered, intentionally and willfully, I would say. Together with, I reported 35 of my family, but now I get the news that it's 45. It has been around 10 o'clock in the morning on October 26 that an earthquake hit my camp. The sound of the bombs has been terrifying. Actually, all the people I talked to who have, survived and lived the other attacks on Gaza, they said this is unprecedented. Probably 6-7 missiles or heavy bombs just landed on the home. So you could imagine a bomb, then people would start to run or try, you know, to save their lives. And then another bomb, and then another bomb. So six or seven, according to them. So it's all is gone. Naif Abu Shamala, this is just across my home. 35 of the, actually, well, from Naif, I think 20. And from the other home, Abu Said family, three generation has been wiped out. And there has been the shop underneath the house that people has been, you know, buying stuff for their families, necessary things. So again, gone. And still the owner of the shop, Assad, I just learned this morning, still under the rubble. So it's really horror beyond belief. You cannot try to comprehend, you know, the devastation of the people there and of us here living this trauma. It has, if the Israeli occupying forces and the apartheid state want to make the pain collective, every single Palestinian, every generation inside occupied Palestine or in the diaspora, on the refugee camp, but to feel it. They bombed these homes. People are still mourning. People are still digging the rubbles, trying to recover the body of Assad. And still, you know, leading this epic resistance, going to bakery, get, you know, bread, get water, go try to bring a smile to the faces of the children. It's really that every minute you just see the pain, but you see the resistance. You see the hope. And this is what I always say. They might drop thousands, tons of bombs, as Ali Abu Nama has mentioned, twice like Hiroshima on this dot, but they would never be able to wipe out our dedication for freedom, for justice. And, you know, it's really difficult sometimes to find the word amid this situation. But yeah, I mean,
yeah. Yeah, of course. And Khaida, you were just there with your family and colleagues. Can you talk about what you're going through as well?
Well, actually, right now, as a Palestinian living in the diaspora, I think it's the hardest thing being away from your homeland and being away from your people, particularly when they are your family and your loved ones. The ongoing situation there is really just a source of great sorrow and pain that brings every day a new story to our homes. Whether it's a new detail of sufferings from our own home that was lost in Zahra when it was completely bombarded, 24 residential buildings, each compromising of four apartments for five levels. You're talking about mass destruction of people's homes. Now we're talking over 50% of Gaza. And then it just carries on with more devastating news. On October 25th, my aunt's house, October 24th, my aunt's house from my dad's side, in Hayy al-Amal in Khan Yunis, was hit, and a whole square of many homes, three of them were my dad's family's side. What we know were at least 50. What was pulled out were 35. The rest are still under the rubble. 2 days later, the Abu Shamala massacre. You know, we can't keep up with the martyrs. Every day it's a new list. It's somebody that you know. It's somebody that you've met. It's somebody that's touched you. It touched your life. Julia, my niece, I lived there for a year and a half, and I volunteered with a lot of human rights and youth organizations and NGOs. And I lived at my aunt's house, and every day I came home to Julia, every day. I saw every single little step that, you know, she took into her development of 2.5 years. And Julia is just one of almost 4,000 kids now, little angels that are going. And, you know, you recall and you say, children, innocent, they don't have anything to do with war, or they don't know anything that is beyond their home, beyond the embrace of their mother. And Julia died in her mother's arms. And, you know, we have a belief in Islam that if God has chosen these people to go as martyrs, then they go. They are the children. They will be uplifted with the least amount of pain. But it's the people that are left behind. It's the people that now you're looking are injured and don't have the right, you know, humanitarian aid reaching them. We're talking about not just water and food. We're talking about diseases. We're talking about infections. We're talking about amputations. We're talking about, you know, doctors that are using vinegar instead of medical supplies because they are running out. We're talking about a completely collapsing system, and it is collapsed because so many hospitals are closing. Every day we're hearing. Yesterday, doctors, instead of pleading to the international community, decided to plead to the Gazan community. They were asking, if anybody has a liter of gasoline, please bring it to the hospital, because if we don't have, anything will help. People are using oil for their cars just to get through. Then 2 days ago, we see some of the cars that are going on Salah al-Din. Every day I took that road to Salah al-Din from Khan Yunis to Gaza. And to see a tank there, and it deliberately targeted that car and deliberately targeted the bus after with people. UN, UNRWA, buses that have been taking people from point A to point B also targeted. Israel is above the law. It's above international human law. It's decided to go ahead with every single war politics and policies that it wants to do, and it knows that nobody can stop it. I talked to my friends when I was in the airport. I called my friend Shaima, and she's telling me, I'm so sorry, I missed your call last night. I literally just escaped death. Shaima Shawa, her dad, Nabil Shawa, is now volunteering at Al-Aqsa Hospital every day in Tell el-Hawa. And the horrors that she tells me that are happening in the hospitals. But despite that, she's still apologizing to me for not answering my call while bombs were falling on her house. 4 bombs fell on her house. Her and her uncle's family miraculously got out of that house. We talk about my friend Lina and Dream, who I posted something on social media, 21 bodies in body bags. And they said, that's my family. That's 21 of our close family. My friend today, Dana Abu Eid, from Jabalia refugee camp, 80 of her family. We're talking massive. We say we are not numbers, but when we actually come down to it and we're talking about numbers, it's like, how do you fathom such amounts of people gone from under your, you can't understand it. And not only that, now you start wondering, if I go back to Gaza, what is left? What will be left? Who will be left? Okay, we're mourning our family one day, we're mourning our family the next day, then we're mourning our friends' families the next day, and then we're mourning our losses every single day, we're mourning a loss. But at some point, everybody in Gaza is our family. Everybody is our bloodline. Everybody's our community. And you start wondering, what else needs to be said? What else needs to be shown? What else needs to be conveyed to these politicians that are sitting on seats, powerful seats? Yeah, I mean, really, words are starting to run dry. My friends, Mu'taz and Hind, they're journalists on the ground. Every day, they are appealing to the international community, asking for protection, showing the day lives. Sorry, I don't want to take much more of the time, but
horror beyond belief, probably that's you know, I'm
I keep saying, because it is impossible for us to comprehend. I mean, it's the scale of the genocide. I don't know a single person in Gaza or from Gaza that I have spoken to that has not lost, I'm not talking about 1, 2, 3 friends or family, dozens. Gaza is a small community. It's 2.3 million people. It's a small territory. Now we're talking about close to 10,000 people, and you know, many are under the rubble. That means 4 out of every 1,000 people in Gaza have been killed. It won't be long if this doesn't stop, that we get to 1% of the population, one in every 100 that's being killed. And we're not, and the number of injured is always multiples of the number killed. And I just keep saying, the only thing it reminds me of is, you know, all our lives we hear these stories of Holocaust survivors who will say, you know, I'm the only person left from my family. I lost, you know, everyone on my mother's side, everyone on my father's side. I was the only survivor, or my father was the only survivor. This is what I'm now hearing from people in Gaza. Yeah. Just entire families wiped out. And you say that what more can we say, or what more can we show? They know what's happening, and they're doing this to us deliberately. And that's the part that is really unbearable. It's not that they're not educated or they can't see. They know. And what they're doing instead is saying, what kind of spin can we put on this? What kind of public relations can we do to distract people from this deliberate slaughter that, that we're doing? And that is just the thing that is impossible to bear.
It's a continuation, really, of just dehumanization and desensitization of Palestinian lives lost. You know, there's a famous poem, "My body's a TV'd massacre." Palestinians' bodies are becoming a TV'd massacre. And every day they're coming and showing you, you know, imagine for a moment living in a place where every breath feels like a struggle, where fear and uncertainty are your constant companion, where basic necessities like food, like water, like electricity are scarce. You're talking about the blackouts. Yesterday, again, they put Gaza on a blackout, a complete blackout. We couldn't reach anybody. My uncle had a heart stroke yesterday, 2 days ago, from the situation that's happening. And really, you look back, and this is history playing again. My grandfather, after he was expelled from Sawafir, and he was living in the tents in Khan Yunis, and he looked and he had all these lands, acres and acres of land, and he saw his situation now in Gaza, living on you know, UNRWA base, or at the time it wasn't even UNRWA.
It was the Quakers.
The Quakers. Yeah. And he had a brain stroke, and he was paralyzed for the rest of the time that he was there. Now my uncle is living that time again. And we're living the Nakba times again, seeing the tents come up in Khan Yunis. It's surreal. It's surreal.
Yeah, it's like it's, the history is repeating itself. Like, I think some of the people told me, I think we're living in October 2023, to wake up to think ourselves we are in October 1948. Mm-hmm. It's really horror being believed with all the meaning of the word. Every single soul is feeling it at the moment. And still this cry for stopping the genocide that everyone is suspecting, including these newspapers, when we want to use the term. Now, the UN officials, lawyers, experts, human rights have, you know, been not only resigning, but saying that's exactly match the textbook of the definition of genocide. It is all these statements made by the Israeli politicians, military, cabinets, government, intellectual, journalists. I mean, those people who are inflicting this death on Gaza children, they have been receiving these messages from the children at school, probably 20 years ago, according to Chris McGreely in The Guardian, kill the Arabs. Those children now are in these tanks killing the Arabs. This is the dehumanization of the Palestinian, the dehumanization of everything Palestinian. So Hamas run hospital. Hamas run school, Hamas run orphanage, as, you know, this justification to go ahead. All these statements we hear in by politicians, not only the Israelis, but also the Western leaders, Mr. Biden, suspecting all these numbers, and if they are dead, they must be terrorists. This is really unbelievable how this complicity, how this bankruptcy of the West. Gaza is the graveyard of international law, graveyard
of Western morality. Shame on the world. And, you know, even here, when we're trying, you know, to give some advices for Shaima Shawa, when their home has been bombed, as a friend, we said, take our home in Zahra. I am happy she did not. Because all my neighbors, all my family, even who live in Zahra, ended in streets. You talk about thousands of people trapped. This is a starvation. This is Dov Glass when he said, we're not going to starve them. We're going to put them on a diet. They now discovered after 16 years of inhumane blockade, they cannot put an end of this willingness for freedom, for dignity. So now the plan of annihilation, of genocide, of expulsion, of continuing the unfinished project of Nakba. This is what we see it. You know, my grandmother has been always telling me, whenever we have a generation, they come and kill it. 1956, 1967, 1987, 1994, 2000. Actually, I was saying, what she said, now when I just put every few years this intentional killing of the children, it is the history. And you know what? When we lost our home in Zahra, you know, even a small place that have all the memories. We don't have any memories in Beit Daras because my family has been expelled, everything destroyed. So all the memories we built in the past 40 or 50 years, the photograph, the first step of my daughter, the painting that my brother-in-law gifted us, my hard-earned certificates, every single thing of a home, a warm home, is gone. All what you held dear, this is why I say they want this, I would say, loss to be collective and felt and continue. So when my grandmother was telling me how they destroyed the home, and then in 1970s, the Israelis started to let Palestinian refugees visit their villages, and she asked him, will you go and visit your home? He said, I would die, because my home is my flesh, is my sweat, is my blood. It is the broken person you see now. You know now, if my grandfather is alive, I would tell him, there is more, you know, or a worse thing or painful thing, not being able to walk in the ruins of your home, but to watch it streamed, live streamed on TV, and you know, feel this powerlessness. And you said, it's okay. The home could be compensated. We can build. But then 24th of October, my husband's sister, all her children, grandchildren, and grandchildren, three generations wiped out, gone. And then the 26th of October, my family, 35, 40, 42, again, numbers. We are not numbers. I mean, as Ghaida said, it's going to be so difficult to get to Khan Yunis, and I am not received by Aisha and Naif and their wife. The minute I step in the camp, all the camp come to congratulate us and hug us and say, how are you, and all of that. And every single day they would share whatever they cooked. This hospitality, generosity, the richness of the Palestinian people, no one ever could understand. Yeah, they are the talented, the gifted, the most beautiful souls.
Gaza has a magic about it, really. Yani, I left Canada 2021 because after the aggression that happened in 2021, I wanted to go see my uncles. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to see Gaza. I wanted to spend time. Life here will pass by you so quick and you won't feel the time go by. And when I went there, really, I understood what it means to feel the magic of Gaza, to feel the magic of people. Yani, Gaza is much more developed than a lot of places here in Canada. And people are shocked by that. We have some of the best restaurants, some of the best food, some of the nicest views on the beachfront. We have a crazy amount of talent. I've worked with so many of the youths that actually are out there. Their work is outsourced to the world because of how talented they are. And these are young people that will speak English, French, German, and they've never stepped a foot outside of Gaza. Fluent. Gazans have a love for life. Palestinians have a love for life. It's not what we only see on TVs. And I know we've gotten used to seeing these bodies come time and again, but they just want to live. They want the freedom. They want to be able to travel. They want to be able to study outside. They want to, and that's their right. That's one of the most basic human rights.
And this is what we should have.
Yeah, yeah.
So this concept of denial for all these youth, actually, when I look again at statistics, 47% of Gaza are children, 55 are under the age of 21. And I go every summer, I see these talented people, and you see this occupation mastering the land, the, you know, the sea, the air. You cannot put a step outside Gaza. You can, we have the best beaches, Mediterranean. You cannot fish. You know, people even, you know, people talk a lot about this genocide. But take me as an example. I finished a high school in 1988 or 89. When I tell the people here that I was denied the right to go to university, they say outside. I said, no, no, in Gaza. They said, what, for a few months, your family doesn't have money? I said, no, because Israel, the apartheid state, have decided to close all the universities in Gaza for 6 years. So 18,000 students my age at that point of time were denied. Multiply it with 6 years. You know, I was living next to the beach because I live in Khan Yunis camp. The beach is like 10 minutes from my home, walking. Mm-hmm. And I won't be able to go because of the settlements. It's only for Jewish youth only. You know, at the checkpoint in Gaza, and this now resonates with what is happening in West Bank, when we have been held on the checkpoint in ambulances, while my husband, nephew, has been bleeding, and they would stop the checkpoint so that they allow the cars of tomatoes and cucumbers to be sent from Gush Katif illegal colonies to inside Palestine or Israel. This is, you discover that you're not worthless. Your life doesn't matter, but Palestinian life matters. And you see this, you know, pattern of dehumanization, of cancer, of demographic bomb, of a human animal. Let them go to the hill, level them all. There is no civilian in Gaza. This is the same discourse and rhetoric that has been used for slavery, for enslavement, for the ethnic cleansing here in Canada and all the settler colonial states. This is a pattern, and Israel now doing it, sadly, unfortunately, with the full complicity of the Western leaders who talk about human rights. And every expert say that matches the text, but they said, no, 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 no. It's only, it's the story of the occupying power. And this is sometimes what hits you as intellectual. It's really an insult to our intellect to accept, not to investigate, but to accept the discourse of the Israeli occupying power to start the narrative and then carry on. That's what's the most, you know, horrible thing, to be here in diaspora, watch life, because we are glued to TVs and we see these massacre and what is reaching this world, probably 1% of what we watch here at our home. And not only that, to live the dehumanization of the media here and this ignorance, this complicity and this powerlessness. And you know what, if I want to end, we still get the hope from the people. This morning I called my uncle, and he has two daughters who finished medicine from Egypt. And now they are in the UN schools. And he said, Noor today have seen probably hundreds of patients. But you know, she writes these prescriptions, but where to get the medicine? People are sharing now the diabetes pills, the blood pressure. You see this epic of, you know, solidarity, of cooperation, of one body. Mm-hmm. And this is what gives you hope. People still go bury the bodies, go to hospital, give water for the doctors or some meals. They go and, you know, volunteer with each other. It's really an epic. And this is what I always say, this will, this hope, this will, no bomb would be able to wipe out our dedication for our rights, our dignity, full equality, ending of this blockade, return. I mean, when they talk now all this narrative about what is happening, about what is going to be the situation after these massacre and genocide. Again, the same colonial narrative, because they want to impose all of these, plans. But as Ali said, it failed everywhere. Why it would succeed in Palestine? It wouldn't, it hasn't, and it won't.
Hada Ajil and Haida Hamdan, we want to thank you for being with us today on just, as you said, these are all unspeakable times for you and your family and your community and your loved ones, and for all of us so far away in, you know, across the world and watching this on our screens and getting messages from our friends. And so we are with you. We're all holding each other in this. And I just want to thank you both again for being with us. We'll have you back on again. Hada Ajil, she is an academic, visiting professor in political science at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And your daughter is Haida Hamdan. Both of you, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And I won't say stay strong, because it's hard for us to stay strong. I will say is hold each other and support each other, because that's really all we can do.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for being here.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Now, while all the attention has been, or most of the attention has been on what has been happening in Gaza over the last month, there's also been an immense amount of Israeli repression against Palestinians in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, where more than 10,000 Palestinians have been detained. There have been raids, there have been killings, there's been torture. And on a tremendous scale. And this is what the Palestinian activist Issa Amro went through recently. He's been an activist for a very long time, very high profile Palestinian activist in the West Bank. And this is the torture that he experienced very recently. He was talking on the Useful Idiots podcast with Katie Halper and Aaron Mate over the weekend about his experience in Israeli detention. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Useful Idiots, where we speak to human rights activist Issa Amro.
He's based in the occupied West Bank, and he recently had a harrowing experience at the hands of Israeli soldiers. He was abducted, tortured, kicked out of his home, and he's going to tell us about it. This is not the first time something like this has happened to him, and this is routine for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And at a time when global attention is understandably focused on the horrific massacres in Gaza by Israel, we also wanted to make sure that we pay attention to what's going on in the West Bank. So here is Issa Amro talking to us about what he went through. Issa Amro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to join you. It's my pleasure.
Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking from Hebron and from a friend's house.
So let's start just with your own personal situation. You are a prominent activist based in Hebron in the occupied West Bank. You were recently displaced from your home. But talk to us about what happened.
Before I talk about being displaced from my home, I want to talk about what happened to me on October 7th. There are a lot of videos of Palestinian detainees being dehumanized, tortured from the Israeli soldiers. I was the first Palestinian to be detained by the Israeli soldiers on October 7th. It was the worst experience ever. I didn't expect that I will be released or I will go back home alive. When I heard about what's going on Gaza borders, I went back home, Tal Rumeida. I found out my Israeli settler neighbors, the settlers who are my neighbors in Tal Rumeida, who we know each other very well, and they are very extreme, very fanatic, and described by many Israelis that they are fascist. They were in army uniform, and they blocked me from going to my house, and they cocked their gun to shoot me, and even one of them hit me and pushed me. So I decided to go from another route. I did. I almost reached my house. I was at the gate outside. 15 soldiers jumped on me, handcuffed me, blindfolded me, and took me to the military base in Tal Rumeida. Then they tied my mouth too. So my mouth, my eyes, my hands to the back. And they came from the back and tied the handcuffs to the point, it's plastic, that blood didn't reach my fingers for 10 hours. Until now, I don't feel in my hands. And I think I need an operation. It's not the only story. Then I was beaten. I was kicked. I was hit. Each soldier who was passing by me when I was in the military base spat at me. They opened the air condition on very cold temperature. I was shaking, pleading them, begging them to stop torturing me. But what I got was more violence toward me. Even, you know, they sexually harassed me. Settlers in an army uniform who I know their voice, but I'm blindfolded to maximum and I was in pain. They came and they started threatening to shoot me, to kill me. They punched me in the face and they say, Isa, this is what you get if you talk about us. Other soldiers did the same. That torture continued for 10 hours. Imagine that from late morning to the midnight. Then I was released without telling me why they detained me. And they didn't check my ID. They didn't check I had a bag. They didn't check the bag. They know me well. They know my politics. And the majority of them were my neighbor settlers in an army uniform. They joined the army after a few hours of what happened in Gaza. And they didn't care about what was going on in Gaza and about the Israeli civilians being killed in Gaza, which I'm against. I told them I'm against violence. I'm against targeting any civilians, not only the Israeli civilians, not Palestinians. All civilians should be protected. This is what I was telling them, but they didn't care. They were rejoicing. They were singing. They were listening to music. Not only that, normal settlers, they came and took a selfie with me. Settlers women, they came and took selfie with me and they know me, you know, and they were celebrating that I am being in that situation. Really, I was traumatized and I felt that it's my last minutes in life. I was released to my house in Tal Rumeida. I didn't get any medical treatment and I was locked in my house, because they closed the whole area. 1 week I was in the house and I'm living alone. I don't cook. I eat from the market, from the restaurants, okay? I was with very, very little food in the house for 1 week. When I decided to go outside to get some medical treatment, when I had the courage and they opened the curfew for 1 hour, I went out. When I came back, I was detained again for 1 hour and a half. And they attacked my house, the settlers in an army uniform. They damaged my food I brought in, and they stole my house key. I was lucky that I was hiding another spare key. Then I went into the house, and I was told that I'm not allowed to leave the house until I coordinate with the army. How to coordinate with the army? Who knows? 1 week I was staying in the house. Another week, I asked Israeli friends to bring me food and to bring to my cat. You know, I had small cats, kittens, three, and their mother was not feeding them. So I decided to bring them food. The soldiers refused. When my Israeli friends from Jerusalem came to bring food to me and to the cats, they were prevented for the first time. The second group were attacked by the Israeli settlers in an armed uniform. They beat them up. Then they broke into the house to search it. They threatened me that I'm not allowed to receive guests, to receive journalists. Then the army asked me to leave the house. I told them it's my house. I have no other place to go because I know what is in their minds. What was in my mind? 48 Palestinian refugees leaving their villages, their houses, and they will be not able to come back. So I refused. I stayed. Friday, October 20th, Yehuda Shaul, from he's one of the founders of Breaking the Silence, and a journalist, Australian journalist, from ABC News, very famous, came to visit me in the house and to write an article about what's going on in the West Bank during the war in Gaza. So 10 minutes later, army came, Israeli police came. I was documenting that. And then they asked them to leave. They refused because the Australian journalist has a GPO card as a journalist where he's allowed to be in the war in Gaza. So that allows him to be everywhere. And Yehuda Shaul is an Israeli, and the Israeli settlers are around, and they should have the same treatment. Not the police and the army forced them to leave physically. Then I was evicted from my house violently by the Israeli soldiers. And they gave me a few minutes to take some small belonging. And since October 20th, I'm not allowed to go back to my house in Tarumeda. It's not a normal house. It's my dream. It's my life. It's my passion. It's where I do my nonviolence activities, where I used to receive diplomats. Many American lawmakers were there. Many European lawmakers were there. Many celebrities were in that house. The house is the symbol of peace, the symbol of nonviolence resistance, and the house now is unfortunately closed. I'm not allowed to go. I don't have enough clothes. I don't have any place to go. I go to this friends, that friends. I'm not able to really do interviews because I don't have enough internet. My laptop is inside. That's what's going on.
And overall, with so much global attention, understandably focused on the massacres in Gaza, I don't think people appreciate just what is going on in the occupied West Bank and how your case is not an isolated incident. This is happening everywhere. I mean, can you give us a sense of the overall picture right now in the West Bank?
To be very honest, I was shy to talk about what happened to me when I see Palestinian kids being slaughtered in Gaza. What to say? I hear the airplanes and the jets, Israeli jets, they go from Hebron to Gaza to bomb civilians, hospitals. Each time I hear them, I say, what happened to me? I can't compare it. But really, in West Bank, there is unannounced war on the Palestinians. They closed all over West Bank. Nobody can go out of their villages, of their compounds. There is a kind of lockdown. We are in small, big jails. Hebron alone, Ramallah alone, Bethlehem alone, and the other Palestinian communities are alone. Not only that, anybody they catch, they torture, they beat up, they dehumanize people. Now, tens of videos of the Israeli soldiers detaining Palestinians, as what happened to me. They handcuff them, they blindfold them, even they reach the point to make them naked. I was lucky that they didn't, force me to be naked and be tortured by them. But I see a lot of videos now. Whenever I see a video of Palestinians being detained that way, dehumanized that way, I see myself because I felt that. You know, it was so painful for 10 hours, to be handcuffed with plastic cuffs and very tight to your skin. That, it's really a kind of hurting you all the time, slaughtering you, slaughtering your hands, and you feel crazy about it. And I see that many videos, and the soldiers are celebrating, rejoicing all over. So people are afraid to pass the checkpoints. They don't go. People are staying in. They don't go to work. They don't go to universities. People are intimidated in a way. They left their homes from some certain areas. Until now, 20 Palestinian communities left their communities, their villages, their towns because of the Israeli soldiers' violence and Israeli settler violence. Many, many communities were attacked. Many communities were not able to get food or to get any kind of services. And it's a kind of a war. Pogroms every day. People are afraid to be killed. Last compound or last Palestinian village was Zinuta in South Mount Hebron. The whole village left, around 35 families, because of settler violence and soldiers' violence. They come to your house during the night and they put it upside down. They come to you and tell you, if you stay, you will be killed. And this happened in Hebron, in Tal Romeda, in H2, and it's happening all over. So I remember 1948, how the Haganahs and the Irguns, Israeli militias, you know, at that time, forced Palestinians to leave their homes in purpose. And this is what is happening now in West Bank. They are trying to create facts in the grounds to really displace Palestinians. So Israeli government, current government, it will be easy for them to annex Area C, H2 in Hebron, and East Jerusalem to Israel without the Palestinians. They want to annex the land without the Palestinians. And this is what we were talking all the time, that they will use any opportunity where the eyes are not looking or concentrating or documenting what is happening in West Bank to do whatever they want. And everything is happening under the eyes of the Israeli soldiers, the eyes of the Israeli police, and the eyes of the Israeli government. The Israeli government gave them army uniform and gave them weapons. This is what happened to me. You know, who tortured me? They were my settlers' neighbors. And they are not in the reserve duty because they are very old. So it's happening all over West Bank like that.
You don't have to answer this question, and I'll cut it out if you don't want to. But you said you were sexually harassed. Can you, if you're comfortable, tell us what that means?
I really didn't talk about it until now. But really, they got close to my face with their body. And they say that they will rape me, the soldiers. And they, one of them said, you are my bitch. And I will fuck you now. It happened maybe 2-3 times. And I fainted 2 times because of the pain. I was sweating. And it was so painful, you know, to live in that situation. And not only that situation, physical pain and mental pain. And really, really, to be very honest with you, they didn't show me any kind of mercy. And I was between around 30 soldiers in the military base. And all of them were rejoicing, happy about what was happening to me. And the unit, the army unit, are from Nahal. And Nahal, they are the Israeli soldiers from Israeli leftist background, the majority of them. And who joined them were the settlers in Tal Romeda and Shoah District, who are very violent, and they are Kahanists, they are Bengvir. So the leftists in Israel from the background, their background are leftists, joined the extremists to do this to me, and not only to me. I know that many, many Palestinians, they detained, arrested around 1,700 Palestinians until now from West Bank, 1,700. It's more. If they arrest around 100, I think maybe the majority of them happened to them what happened to me. 2 Palestinians died inside recently after being detained after October 7th. Both 2 were I think killed because of torture. Both of them, one is in his 20s and one I think in late 50. And both of them, I think, passed away because I felt that I will die. Me, Isa, I felt I will die. And they didn't care. When I fainted, they didn't care to bring me a doctor or to bring a paramedic to me.
Isa, I know that, you know, it's, I know it's not much, but I'm wondering if you've seen the images around the world of people protesting in solidarity with Palestine and whether, you know, that makes any difference or it gives people at least any sense that they're not alone inside the occupied territories, seeing these images around the world, these massive protests, including in Grand Central Station of New York, where many Jews came together to say, not in our name.
I'm very proud of the Jews in the United States. I was moved. It made me feel bitter. And it made many Palestinians feel much, much bitter that they are not alone. And what is happening to them is making people move, learn more about the reality of the Israeli occupation and apartheid. Any small action, any tweet, any visible solidarity with the Palestinians give us energy, give us hope, give us protection. Because it's very obvious that it's not a local conflict, it's a global conflict. Russia and the United States are fighting about Palestine. And everywhere people are fighting about Palestine, about what's going on. It's bigger than Palestine. And we saw how the American administration, how UK, United, the Europe and many other countries gave Israel that much weapon. If you are willing to give Israel weapon, it means you have influence on Israel to end its occupation and its apartheid and to be under the international law, which is the umbrella of everybody. Treat us as you treat Ukraine. You know, we are under occupation and Ukraine is under occupation. If you love Ukrainian, I have a brother who lives in Ukraine. He's Ukrainian. And he's so worried about us more than he's worried about his family in Ukraine. Because what is happening to us, it's much worse of what Russia did to the Ukrainian. So please, you know, I want a real, one standard for all the human beings in the world. And everybody should know that Palestinians are not animals who are seeking shelters and food. It's not about that they want to move us to Sinai and give us some food. No, we want to be treated as a nation who deserve freedom and justice and equality. And the people who are chanting in DC, in New York, in UK, really, it's really amazing when they are chanting for free Palestine. It means they are in the right side of history. This is a historical time to show where are you exactly, and the people should choose where they are. Are they with the offender or with the defenders or with the victims? Because it's not equal war. It's oppressor and oppressed people. And you can't judge people when they have no basic human rights. You can't judge them. You can't evaluate what they are doing in the time that you don't give them enough food, you don't give them enough electricity, you don't give them enough water, you are looking them, seizing them, then you judge them. Judge yourself first for what are you doing to them and what are you doing to the Palestinians since 75 years. So Israel should be accountable according to the international standards. And we are maybe suffering in Palestine now, but really, I'm very happy from all the people who are doing an amazing actions and activities for human rights and for Palestinian rights and for really making a change, because there is no change without a price. We are paying the price. Many people are paying the price, but freedom deserves that we suffer and we sacrifice. But we want to make the offender accountable according to the international standards, according to the American principles, according to the American morals. This is what we are asking. I want the people in the United States and all over the world to act according to their human being morals and principles. That's all.
And how many times, by the way, have you been arrested?
Hundreds of times, detained and arrested. But this was the worst. Not the worst. I don't know how to describe it. I tell you, I thought it's my last minutes in my life. And I didn't expect that I will go back home. And I started I started counting my last minutes in my life. This is what happened to me exactly. And unfortunately, many Palestinians happened to them what happened to me. And I know that the soldiers who did it to me will not be accountable. And who did it to many other Palestinians will not be accountable. Why? Because it's not an individual act. It's a system. A system is like that. It's systematic. behavior from the Israeli soldiers, from the majority of the Israelis, and for sure from the Israeli settlers, and anybody is supporting Israel that blindly is participating on what is happening, what happened to me, and what is happening to the Palestinian civilians first in Gaza and the Palestinian civilians in West Bank.
It's also worth noting that you were someone who has a lot of international contacts. You've been recognized. You've won awards. Who knows what they would have done to you if you didn't have that kind of profile? Who knows if you'd be alive?
If you don't speak English, and if I'm not well connected to media, well connected to celebrities in the world, first, nobody will care. Not many people will care. And nobody will know. This is what I'm saying, that what happened to me is not individual. I'm not alone. I'm telling you, I'm watching many videos. This is what we got, because the soldiers were filming themselves and sending it to their WhatsApp internal groups. It happened to me. I heard them taking photos with me and sending it to their groups, to their friends, and celebrating and all of that. But they didn't show it out. But many other videos are now circulating everywhere. Until now, I saw maybe 10 videos. 10 videos until now. Exactly what happened to me and more.
And I've heard that there are TikTok challenges.
TikTok, yes. TikTok, how to dehumanize Palestinians and torture Palestinians. And TikTok don't close their TikTok accounts. My account was closed many times for posting human rights videos. TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, they allow them to show hate, to incite, to kill us, and to do whatever they want, because we have censorship in our content and social media as well.
One final question from me. Can you talk about the nonviolent organizing and activism that you engage in?
I'm organizing nonviolent sit-ins, protests, rallies. I document the human rights violations. I train Palestinian families. I lead them to document the human rights violation. We organize campaigns in the community to do public events, to do maintenance to the houses, to try to make Palestinians stay within their communities and in their homes. We do advocacy, we do tours to increase awareness, we do a lot of films and a lot of media, we do legal work, and we do a lot of children activities. We support our women leadership in the community. We do a lot of community organized actions, and we create a lot of facts in the ground. We try to create a cinema, we create the kindergarten, we create a women center. I was creating a cinema, a new cinema in my community house, in my house. Now it's not possible, but we'll continue. And nonviolence means you have to be creative to make the occupation costly. So I'm telling people who are asking us what we can do, be creative and think how you can influence the occupation and make it costly on the supporters of the occupation, because Israel would not be able to maintain the occupation and apartheid for that long without your leaders. You know, this is something very important. So think about how to make it costly for them, but use non-violence resistance, use the human being principles and morals to make it costly on them.
Issa Amra, we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. I can't thank you enough. Any final comments you want to leave us with today?
I talked about what happened to me as a victim, but I'm telling you, what happened to me will not make me stop fighting the Israeli occupation, because it's my duty. And I'm telling people to make them understand the reality of the Israeli occupation, the reality of the Israeli apartheid, and to motivate them to act against the Israeli apartheid and the Israeli occupation, and without making it costly, without concrete nonviolence actions, nothing will change.
Issa Amra, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I'm so sorry about what is happening to you, but I'm so inspired by your perseverance and persistence and bravery.
Thank you both. Thank you for what are you doing too. You are doing amazing solidarity, and keep doing it. Thank you very much. I hope to see you soon in Palestine.
Yes.
Yes.
And please do make sure you follow Issa on social media. He's at Issa Amro, ISSAMRO, at Twitter and Instagram. It's really important to follow him because he's documenting a lot of the abuse that he's describing. Obviously, he didn't document the abuse that he described in this interview, but he has a lot of interactions with the Israeli authorities, some of which he does capture on video.